Ready?
Our evening began in Peter Seychelles' comfortable study in his New York townhouse.
No sleep till
Brooklyn! Yeah! Brooklyn, Bronx, Queens, it's that end. From the Battery to the top of Manhattan.
Yo, rope!
Greetings, everybody. My name is Jim Shear, and welcome to the Brouhaha. On today's episode, I'm going to pay tribute to Matt Dyke. And let's face it, Matt was the man who put the pieces in place for the creation of Paul's Boutique. We call people like that catalysts. Would have been possible without him. He got the Beastie Boys and the Dust Brothers together in the same room. And I guess that room being his small apartment. Now, most of you know that Matt Dyke and Mike Ross founded Delicious Vinyl, which brought us the Tone Low Kits, Funky Cole Medina and Wild Thing, and Young MC's Bust a Move. But right now, let's concentrate on the late 1980s. The Beastie Boys get into their beef with Def Jam. And there's a couple different stories. I mean, very similar, but the outcome's the same. One story says that Matt Dyke discovers that the Beastie Boys are leaving Def Jam, so he sends them a tape of a material that would later become Shake Your Rump and Car Thief. And there's another story of the Beastie Boys heading out west, crossing paths with Matt Dyke, which would make sense since he was a central music figure in LA at the time. His DJ sets had become legend at that point. He pops in one of his beats, and the Beastie Boys instantly fall in love with it. And there's a story of Mike D saying, "Ooh, can I buy that?" So the Beastie Boys decide to team up with Matt Dyke and the Dust Brothers, and they create Paul's Boutique, which would become a flop, but would later become one of the most critically acclaimed albums of all time. An album that you could not make today because you could never clear the samples. So Matt Dyke, and I heavily suggest reading Dan Leroy's 33 and a third book, because I never knew a lot about Matt Dyke until I read the book. And I guess it makes sense because in the early 90s, Matt Dyke sells off his share of Delicious Vinyl, retreats to his mansion in Echo Park, and really is never heard from again until Dan Leroy tracks him down. And on today's episode of the Brouhaha, I'm going to speak with Dan about him speaking with Matt Dyke. And then Dan Leroy's co-author for the sequel to Paul's Boutique 33 and a Third, For Whom the Cowbell Tolls, Peter Relic, actually gets to hang out with Matt Dyke, and we'll talk about that a little bit. But yeah, Matt Dyke, at the height of his creative juices, decides to give it all up. Now, there's stories of Matt Dyke fighting with his demons. Apparently, he was addicted to drugs, if you read the LA Times article. In that article, he asks a friend, "Do you know what's the worst thing for a drug addict?" And his friend says, "What?" And then he says, "Unlimited resources." And I believe it was Hayes, the graphic artist in Dan Leroy's book, he said that Matt Dyke wanted to make $1 million, retire, and just do drugs for the rest of his life. And apparently that's what he did. He never left his mansion. I guess sometimes he would cruise down the hill, get supplies, and then go back home. Now, last week, I believe it was on March 13th, Delicious Vinyl posted that after battling a brief illness, Matt Dyke died. And depending on which story you read, some say he was 55, some say he was 56 years old. A couple days after that, it was reported that Matt Dyke actually passed away on January 6th, and he was surrounded by his brother and his sister. And they didn't let anyone know because they wanted Matt to have his privacy. And it was reported that Matt Dyke died of salivary gland cancer. And that is the same illness, the same disease that claimed the life of Adam Yauch. So let's take a break right now. And when we come back, I'm going to call Dan Leroy, author of the Paul's Boutique 33 and a Third book, and we will chat about his conversations with Matt Dyke. All right, and now I am joined by Dan Leroy, author of the 33 and a Third Paul's Boutique book, as well as its sequel, For Whom the Cowbell Tolls. So, Dan, did you ever get to meet Matt Dyke? I know you interviewed him.
We never met face-to-face. We talked a bunch of times around the time, or right before the time that the 33 and a Third book came out. The guy who did spend some time with him was my co-author of For Whom the Cowbell Tolls, Peter Relic, who got to not only spend time with Matt, but also retrieved, I think, a lot of really interesting memorabilia from Matt's place and some stuff that made see the light of day in some form, we hope. But no, just had the pleasure of talking to Matt over the phone, which at the time it happened was, that was an event enough. I think he had not talked to anyone or had been interviewed, at least by anyone, for a number of years. So I was very glad to make his acquaintance via phone.
Yeah, how did you set that up?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you and everybody else who listens to this podcast. So, you know, I tried for months to get a hold of him, and everyone that I talked to had told me, well, look, Matt doesn't talk to anyone. He's not going to talk to you. And I talked to people who knew Matt at one time, who were very close to him, who said, listen, I hope you do get a hold of him, because if you do, I'd love to talk to him, because he has not talked to me either in a number of years. So the way it all transpired, without getting too boring or too Mission Impossible-esque, was that one morning I was sitting around and I got a call from a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy who knew a guy who told me, listen, I heard you want to talk to Matt. In 10 minutes, you're going to get a call from a guy who's going to connect you with Matt. And he did. And that's how it all started. And from there, had the opportunity, like I said, to talk to him quite a few times. You could make the argument that, you know, he hadn't talked to anyone, at least in that kind of setting, for long enough that he had a lot to say. And I was lucky to be around and in the right setting to receive it.
So when he called you for that first time, what did he say?
That's a funny thing. There wasn't a lot of preamble or I heard you've been stalking me or anything of that nature. In fact, as I recall it, he was kind of surprised, which I think is one of the nice things about Matt is, you know, he really was taken aback, I think, that anyone was interested enough to want to write a book about this record, which he played such a pivotal part mm-hmm. in putting together. And, you know, I know you know this from talking to people and doing the same kind of thing over the years. Sometimes you're really taken aback by the fact that occasionally you run into people who really just don't seem to have any sense of how important something they did is to mm-hmm. so many people. And Matt, I think, was an example of that. He couldn't believe the idea that anyone would want to write a book, a whole book, about this record. So that was his first response. But he loved talking not just about the record, but he loved talking about music. He was such a fan of music that once we got going, we didn't stop for a long time. Because I would say his musical knowledge maybe stopped, at least being as in-depth, right about the time that he sort of took a voluntary retirement from the business. But in the period in which he was working, it was almost unparalleled.
Mm-hmm. So how long were these phone conversations?
Hours.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
He was the guy who I mean, I don't know if I'm gilding the lily here, but he had some stuff to talk about and hadn't had these sorts of conversations. I mean, one way to say it is he hadn't really been interrogated, I think, for quite some time about this stuff. And I don't think he'd ever, even when he was still in the public eye, I don't think he'd ever talked about Paul's Boutique at any length whatsoever. So, we had a lot to talk about. I mean, my favorite memory of all of those conversations, and I think the one that kind of illustrates what kind of guy he was, is one night, I was still living in Connecticut at the time, so I'd been to New York to see a Paul Weller show. And I talked to him after I got back. And he was he was off. He started talking about he'd spent a year in England as a teenager. So he started talking about being a teenage mod, but it wasn't just about the Jam and Paul Weller. He was talking about bands like A Secret Affair, the Purple Hearts, and going down to Brighton. And I mean, the guy just knew mod culture like he knew other kinds of culture.
Right.
Inside and out. And it's just at one level, I just like talking about it with him because I'm interested in that stuff too. But the level of detail, his knowledge was, you don't get that kind of knowledge unless you're completely immersed in the culture that you're talking about. And clearly he was. And the thing that was unique about Matt is he could do that with mod culture, but he could also do it with probably a dozen other musical subcultures as well.
Did it seem like he enjoyed the conversations with you?
I think he did. I think there was a kind of bemused quality to these things all the time, as if he still wasn't 100% sure that, again, anyone would really want to do all this and write a book about it. I think he was still trying to work through the idea of that there would be that much interest in this one record to sustain all these conversations. But that being said, he had a lot to say, and I was glad to be there to hear some of it.
Were you aware of his media habits? Do you know if he watched any TV or was on the internet?
The best way that I can describe it is, it's kind of a sad thing to say, although I think it sort of illustrates again, a little bit about the guy. At one point he was telling me about, one of the things, let me preface it this way. One of the things that I asked him, like anyone I think would ask him, is, hey, was there any other stuff that was recorded for this record that never saw the light of day? Because clearly everyone's memory is, well, we recorded. It was sort of this amorphous thing that really just kind of took shape at the end, which would seem to suggest, well, man, maybe there's some other stuff that's out there. So I asked about that, and he said, well, I have some things. I have some photos because I was interested in photos as well. He had all this stuff. And so naturally I'm thinking, well, if you have it in any kind of digital form, maybe you could send it to me. And it sort of became evident that he just didn't have the computer wherewithal to do anything like that. And he talked about maybe having his sister come and help. And ultimately, I guess you could look at that two ways. One is nothing came of any of those conversations. But the other part of that is that later on, as people who read For Whom the Cowbell Tolls know, Pete was able to track down a couple of those lost recordings. So there was, in the end, some stuff after all. But I guess the best way I would describe it is I think Matt's, at least at the time that I was talking to him, his technical acuity sort of ended right up to the time that the internet sort of took off.
Isn't that wild? Someone who could layer all of those samples couldn't scan pictures? Or we're assuming he couldn't scan pictures?
Well, I mean, I'm going to make that assumption, although I think maybe in his later years he did pick up some of that stuff. And it's also possible, I should say, that could be just he knew how to do it and just didn't want to do that stuff. But I tend to think that the original interpretation is the right one. But yeah, what you said about the technical aspect of this, and that's true of Mike Simpson and John King and Mario C. as well. Every time you listen to that record and you think that these guys are doing what they're doing on what amounts to like a Tandy computer from Radio Shack with a green screen and a flashing cursor, no visuals, no visual interface
whatsoever.
No waveforms, it's all based on based on numbers and feel, some midpoint between the two of these things. And you listen to the way that record sounds, and I guess that's the thing. I don't think anyone who has grown up in a Pro Tools environment can really appreciate what these guys did. It's just foreign to that way of thinking.
Now, was Matt willing to dish on everything, or did he ever hold back?
Because
sometimes when I interview people, it'll be a great conversation, and I'll ask whatever question, and you can tell it strikes a weird chord with them.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I'm going to say I don't think Matt held back. I think if he ever held back, I suppose it maybe came from just, being out of action for a long time. But, he told a lot of stories about a lot of things. He was not... he was not shy about, going after people who need to go after. I think maybe the best example of that is some stuff that ended up in the Cowbell book. And those were some things that came from interviews that Pete had done. He told a story about the Beastie's manager at the time, Andy Slater, who would later go on to be a label head. And he told some stories that nobody else was willing to share, which certainly didn't make Andy Slater, didn't present him in a very favorable light, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
So, there's clearly there was some stuff that went down between Mike Simpson, John King, the whole breakup of that partnership, and I think he was as candid as he could have been at that time. If he wasn't more candid, that's probably my fault, because I just might not have known enough about the situation to ask better questions.
Well, who would have if he was in hiding for 20 years?
Yeah, it was sort of this, I don't know, I sort of had this idea, and the idea actually was born out by events, which was, this is awesome. These conversations are fantastic. I still have a feeling this window is not going to be open for very long. And when the window closes, that's probably going to be it. And that's more or less the way it happened. I don't remember when exactly it was that those conversations ended, but once they did, that was the end of it. So limited engagement.
So how was your last conversation? Did you guys determine that you got enough information, or he stopped calling you?
No, it was more like that. I think it was, there was no, it was very open-ended, and we didn't really plan this stuff out. Sometimes he would just call out of the blue. Sometimes I would call him. And this is over a period of however many months.
So eventually you did get his phone number.
Yes.
Okay. Now, in these conversations, could you determine whether or not he wanted to get back in the spotlight, or was he happy just living in solitude?
The best that I could determine, and I think this also has been borne out by events, I don't think he did. I think he did what he wanted to do. I certainly never got the sense that this was a guy who was unhappy with how things were going. I never, ever, ever got the sense that this was a guy who had bowed out of the game and now was hoping that people would remember what he had done. These kids today, they don't know it. None of that.
In
not
a way,
a
that's such,
not a scintilla
that is,
of that.
I mean, that's badass in a way.
No, it is. I mean, I can't decide sometimes whether that is tragic or whether it's
right.
completely noble or somewhere in between. But I think I lean toward the noble part of it, just on the thinking that there are so few people. And again, you know this from the many folks that you have talked to. Many people will say, yeah, I don't need any credit. I know what I did, and that's good enough for me. And 99% of the time, that's a bald-faced lie, and
mm-hmm.
you know it, and
mm-hmm.
so does the other person. Matt is in that 1% where I think it was actually true.
Now, in your book, you write about how Matt is such a magnetic personality. Did you get that vibe when you spoke with him on the phone?
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Just such a smart guy. Just in talking to him, it was clear, some of the things that other people said. John Seidel, who was a great friend of his, talked a lot in that book and has talked elsewhere about what a magnetic personality was, that he could charm a whole room full of people, that he could, he was just an incredibly charismatic guy. Did that come through, even over the phone? Yeah. Absolutely.
Wow.
And I think some of that is he was just such a smart guy.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds like a generic compliment, but there are smart people, and then there are smart people who are smart because you can just sense in talking to them the depth of their knowledge about whatever it is they happen to be talking about. And that was one of those kinds of guys.
So your co-author for Whom the Cowbell Tolls, Pete Relic,
mm-hmm.
how did he meet up with Matt Dyke?
I'm a little bit hazier on the details of this, but I do know that he was working at the time on some stuff to do with Delicious Vinyl, which
mm-hmm.
is the label that put out those classic records that Matt produced, co-produced. So Pete was working on a project related to this, and Pete was persistent, which I think was, I don't know if that was the whole game, but that was certainly half of the game. And that was kind of how the two of us made our acquaintance, because Pete had called me up or contacted me. I can't remember how it was first, but he said, hey, I'm interested in talking to you. I just got back from Matt Dyke. So immediately I'm like, okay, well, whoever Peter Relic is, he's a serious individual, because not just anybody penetrates the inner sanctum and then comes back to talk about it. So Pete could certainly tell the story a lot better than I can, but what I do remember of it was that he had tried for quite some time, and then he got the phone call like 3 a.m. One night saying, hey, you want to come by the house? Which I think is, that's also a representative of Matt's personality. Okay, look, now I'm ready. Let's do this. And so from there, Pete is a fantastic journalist. Pete is certainly one of the smartest music journalists I've ever met. And clearly, the two of these guys, something clicked. And I'm sure part of that is because of the depth of the shared knowledge. And Pete ended up spending, I think, some fair amount of time with Matt and helped archive some stuff. Not only is Pete the Indiana Jones of our time, in the sense that he uncovered these Lost Paul's Boutique recordings, but he also, I think, is working on archiving some stuff of Matt's, and we hope that will see the light of day someday.
Now, does Pete have that stuff, or was that in Matt's possession?
I think the way I would best describe it is that it was kind of in a, how would I say it, a state of disarray, and he kind of helped catalog this stuff and put it in some sort of order.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think whatever else to say about Matt, I think his archival skills, maybe that's one area where he wasn't as strong. So I think Pete was invaluable in that respect.
Now, does Pete have a copy of the Jerry Lewis? This is one of the Lost Paul's Boutique tracks.
He gave that back, which, again, just goes to show you what kind of guy he is. He uncovers these lost recordings, which, some people would be tempted to take right to eBay or to other channels, and the first thing he did was drove down to Mike D's and returned the stuff to him. So will the general public ever hear this stuff? And I don't know. It seems like a lost opportunity if it doesn't happen. Of course, 2019, coming up on the 30th anniversary of Paul's Boutique.
Right.
The Beasties have their biography or autobiography still in the works.
Mm-hmm. And
so, there's some potential synchronicity here over the next year or 18 months or whatever it would be for something like that to come out. Will it? Your guess, my friend, is as good as mine.
Now, you keep saying Lost Paul's Boutique tracks. Was there more than one?
There was another one. There was a thing that they did. It was kind of a freestyle over the Bonzo's Montreux, the Led Zeppelin track with just a John Bonham drum solo. They did some rhyming over top of that. So technically there are two tracks.
And Mike D has these in his possession.
Yes.
Oh. Now, did Matt Dyke have them? And then
I don't think so.
Oh, so Mike always had them.
Yeah, I mean, this is a conversation that I never had with Matt. Pete probably had it with him once he discovered this stuff. But no, Matt, as far as I know, had no knowledge of this stuff. I mean, I'm sure he remembered doing it, but he probably thought, like everybody else, that those tapes had been lost and would never be recovered.
Because in your book, 30, 30 and a Third, someone talks about the Dust Brothers or Matt sampling Wilson Pickett's Engine Number 9.
And that was, there's actually a chapter in Cowbell that talks about that track. That was Max Perlick who talked about that sample. What he was thinking of was a track that the duo KMD did with that sample in it.
Okay.
And that was, yeah, so it actually wasn't a Paul's Boutique track. It was a track by KMB, which I have to say, if you're talking about great lost artifacts of that era, what an incredible record that is. And that's another one that we hope will see the light of day sometime in its entirety. And of course, there are issues about sample clearance and all the rest of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Things you could do in 1989 are a lot more difficult to do today if you actually, you know, want to make any money doing this stuff. But such an incredible, incredible record, that KMB stuff. If you like Paul's Boutique, and you like really any of the hip-hop of that era,
well,
that KMB record
the distorted vocals on that inspired the Beastie Boys to distort their vocals on Check Your Head.
That is the assertion, although if you take a look... If you take a look at the excerpt of that chapter that ran on the website Ego Trip, you'll see that someone made the claim in the comments that that was exaggerated and that, in fact, that's not where the Beasties got that that influence from. If you have a minute to
Where did they get it from then?
I think the best I would say is check the comments on that story. It's an interesting comment that someone made. It would have to be someone who purportedly has some inside knowledge of that situation. There's not too many people who could make such a claim credibly. It's just an interesting little thing. Look it up.
Well, my question is Mario C. on that page? Did he make a comment?
I don't believe the comment came from Mario. I don't think that is the source of the comment. I won't say any more. It's just an interesting little occurrence out there in cyberspace, and I think you can still track it down and read it.
Because the Beastie Boys, let's face it, they like to borrow. We think of the Beastie Boys with that fisheye lens aesthetic. That could be inspired by Glennie Friedman because he took those early fisheye lens photos. And then years later, when you would see a video or a photo like that, you wouldn't think of Glennie Friedman. You would think of the Beastie Boys.
Well, as you say, and you said it very well, that you know, there's a lot of borrowing going on. And in my book, The people who borrow well are every bit as much, you know, innovators in their own right as the first people who think of it. But as you know, the issue of credit is it's a sensitive one. And when we talk about borrowers and originators, some people feel like it's better to be the latter than the former. In my book, it's the same thing often.
Well, it was John Lennon who said, good artists borrow, great artists steal.
But, you know, and that quote has been attributed. it is. Well, that quote, yeah. You see that quote all the time, and it's attributed to Lennon, it's attributed to Picasso, it's attributed to... It's like a meta comment.
Yeah.
I think the fact that it's attributed to so many famous artists says something about, you know, just the innate truth.
Yeah, wait a second. I'm thumbing through the New Testament, and here it is right here in the Book of John.
See? There's widespread cultural acceptance of this truism.
So, Dan, before we go today, as always, I said, hey, we'll talk for 15 minutes. It's almost a half hour now. I know you are...
Well, that's mostly because I talk at half speed, but that's how I make money on my hourly rate.
So when I speed this up, it's only going to be a three-minute interview.
Exactly, exactly. And unfortunately, my students can't employ the same technology to get through some of these classes faster.
So before we go, I want to point out that the bong hit in Shake Your Rump, that is courtesy of Matt Dyke. And yep. Then Matt Dyke tried to court the Beastie Boys, right? Because he worked at Power Tools, yeah. And they sent the Beastie Boys mm-hmm. a tape, and they really wanted to work on this album because they heard they were leaving Def Jam. And the two songs they were courting the Beastie Boys with were Shake Your Rump and Car Thief. Am I remembering that correctly?
That's correct. Although at the time, going under different names, still kind of embryonic versions, Dust Joint and Full Clout.
Full Clout, yep.
But I think one thing that you say there that I just want to elaborate on, because I think it's an important part of all this, an important part of remembering that, you know, there has been dispute, and you can read about some of it in Cowbell. There's been some dispute about who did what on this record and who did how much of what. And that's always going to be the case, I think, when you have a record that's made under these circumstances, not limited to, but including some of the chemical influences that went into this record. But one thing I don't think anybody would deny is that if Matt Dyke doesn't decide, hey, the Beasties are going to be free of Def Jam, we're going after them, we need to get this project. If Matt Dyke doesn't do that, then you and I aren't having this conversation right now. At least we're not having it about anything Beastie related. Mm-hmm. Matt Dyke was the driving force behind going out and getting these guys. I don't think anybody else involved would have had the stones to do that.
And you know what, Dan?
He did.
You know what? I would have never known that were it not for your book.
Well, that's a nice thing of you to say.
Because growing up, we always thought it was the Dust Brothers. And it was the Dust Brothers, but Matt Dyke, he was just sort of a name floating around in the ether. We didn't know he was such an important player.
The funny thing about it is that I think Matt would have been fine either way. Whether everybody knows that or nobody knew it at all, but the nice thing about it is that, you know, if I played any little tiny part in letting people know that, then I think that's a good thing, because I think Matt deserves to be remembered as, you know, as who he was, which was an incredibly important and influential innovator, not just musically, but culturally.
Mm-hmm. Well said. So rest in peace, Matt Dyke.
Indeed.
Dan Leroy, or I should say, Dan Leroy! Thank you for your time.
Thank you, my friend.
And this beat right here, this is Bonzo's Montro from Led Zeppelin's album Coda. And apparently, the Beastie Boys rhymed over this during the Paul's Boutique sessions. I guess Matt Dyke threw on this beat, and he was scratching Steve Miller's The Joker, I guess the slide guitar, the part that goes wow, wow, over this. And reports say that this kind of sounded like an outtake from License to Ill. And then there's the Jerry Lewis, which was put over this beat called Baby Scratch My Back from Dino, Desi, and Billy. Take a quick listen. Thank you.
So imagine the Beastie Boys doing something over that, and I'm sure they're rhyming the Jerry Lewis, or maybe they have a course, the Jerry Lewis, or do the Jerry Lewis. Now, according to the book For Whom the Cowbell Tolls, written by Dan Leroy and Peter Relic, the Jerry Lewis could have bridged the divide between License to Ill and Paul's Boutique. So maybe if the Jerry Lewis were released as a single, Paul's Boutique would have hit right away. And I kind of like the fact that it didn't hit right away, because it forced the Beastie Boys to do something different again. They build their own studio and they make Check Your Head, my favorite Beastie Boys album. If Paul's Boutique clicks with the public, maybe they never make Check Your Head. The world, is that the Tootsie Roll commercial? The world may never know. So I would hope that sometime in my life, I could hear both Caught and the Jerry Lewis. And not to sound too much like a vulture, but you know how there's a saying, one man's trash is another man's treasure? So curious what was inside of Matt Dyke's Echo Park mansion. Because he was roommates with Jean-Michel Basquiat, and apparently Basquiat gave him a whole bunch of paintings. So there's Basquiat's and just his record collection, the mixtapes, the beats. I wonder if his things were combed through or just tossed away. Once again, I don't want to sound like a vulture. This is just me being curious about things. I mean, his whole life has me curious. At the height of his fame and creative power, he walked away. So who knows why Matt Dyke decided to leave the game for good? Could have been the demons. Maybe he did what he needed to do. Whatever the case, fascinating, fascinating guy. I would have loved to hang out with Matt Dyke for 30 seconds. Because you always hear about his magnetic personality. And you don't even have to be in a room with someone for 30 seconds. Sometimes you just walk into a room and you feel it. And that's the impression I get from all the stories I hear about Matt Dyke. And just listen to his music. Look up some of his playlists. I mean, the man was years ahead of the game. Think of all the rock and hip-hop and mashups that happened 10 to 15 years later. That is going to do it for this episode of The Brouhaha. If you need to reach me, please tweet me at Jim Shear, or you could email me at beastiepodcast@gmail.com. Till next time, my name is Jim Shear, and I will see yins later. That's it, that's all there is. Come on. Yo, we gonna end it on a 1, 2, 3 note. Are you ready? 1, 2, 1, 2, 3. Ah! Guarantee we bring the brouhaha. It's a brouhaha.